don't just quit your job without savings and say, hey, I'm going to build 10 products in 10 months without a cushion, because like product number one and two are very unlikely to succeed. So make sure you're playing, but make sure you have a safety net while you're playing around, because that'll just give you a longer sort of timeline to experiment until you can reach a point where you get lucky.
Hi, and welcome to the Code and Conquer podcast. Today we have Luis Pereira, the creator of AudioPen AI, joining us. Luis is known for building and launching successful online businesses and products in his spare time, outside of running his family's traditional offline business as well. We'll be talking with Luis about his journey into the world of indie hacking, how he built AudioPen using no-code tools, and what advice he has for aspiring online entrepreneurs. Let's jump right in. Hi, and welcome to the Code and Conquer podcast. We're on episode 16 now. Feels like a lifetime that we started with episode 1. And today we have a very special guest that I'm very happy to have here on the podcast. He is called Luis Pereira, and he's done the startup / indie hacker project AudioPen AI, which is one of very many products that he did before. Hi, Luis. Who are you exactly? Where do you come from? And what are you known for these days?
Hi, Tobias. Yeah, I build stuff online as a hobby outside of my day job. And I've been doing that for the past about almost 3 years now, I think so. Somewhere in the first half of 2020 is when I started experimenting with the online world. And yeah, like I live in India, in a small state called Goa on the west coast of the country. And I work a very traditional job in the daytime, which is I run my family business, which is purely offline. And at night, I satisfy another part of my curiosity by just experimenting on the internet, whether it's writing online or building products. Yeah, and I love both parts of my life.
It's actually amazing that you still run the family business. I'm flashed right now that you have the time to do that as well. What's the family business like? Can you talk about what you're doing in your daytime?
Yeah, it's a business based in Goa itself. And mm-hmm. We run supermarkets, so a couple of them in Goa, a hotel and a couple of restaurants as well. And with another few smaller retail businesses here and there.
Wow.
But yeah, I'm in the second generation of the family business. And yeah, it's a responsibility of mine that I've got to look after it and grow it during the day. But I'm fortunate that it gives me enough flexibility and time to be able to do this stuff at night as well. It's not like your typical day job that you're working 12 hours a day and you're exhausted by the end of it. I have a decent amount of flexibility baked in and control over my schedule as well. And I'm grateful for that. So it fits quite well into my lifestyle at the moment.
But still amazing that you can handle both of this. And then also an indie hacker business, which went very well for you. You are known for a product now that's called AudioPen. Can you tell us what AudioPen does and what it does for its users and how you got the idea for it maybe?
Yeah, AudioPen is a very simple tool on the surface, at least. It lets you speak. So it lets you ramble. It records what you're saying. And then it transcribes and rewrites what you said in a style of your choice. So to give you a simple example, if you want to reply to an email, let's say at work, and it's a fairly long and complex email, instead of sitting at your computer and typing it down and, you know, reformatting it and making sure it's polite and politically correct and just well formatted and well written, you could just press record on your computer, ramble out everything that you want the contents of that email to contain, and give AudioPen an instruction to write that in a professional tone, maybe in a polite tone, whatever you want, even in a language of your choice, and it'll do that. And it's obviously not just constrained to email. You can do it for anything. If it's a blog post, you can do it. If it's an SMS, you can do it. If it's, I don't know, like just a tweet, you can do that as well. You can make it write in a style of your choice as long as you give it the content with your voice.
And it's amazing at doing that, actually. Full disclosure, I'm one of your, maybe not earliest, but one of your early users. I bought the lifetime subscription for, I think, $60 it was.
Oh, pretty early, I'll give you that. Thanks for the support.
Yeah, it's an awesome tool. What I'm using it mainly for, just to give more examples, is journaling and also creating content. I'm using two things now to create content for more multiple platforms and also connected to this podcast. But one of them is talking to AudioPen and then just taking the transcription / the summary that it did and then creating tweets from that using other AI tools. But yeah, it's amazing at doing that. How did you like get the idea for it? Because at least in my mind and in my bubble on Twitter, you were the first to come up with that kind of solution.
Yeah, I was the first, but I don't want to take too much credit for the idea because it was quite an accidental sort of discovery. I hadn't seen a tool like that before, and I didn't really envision it becoming the kind of tool it became after I built it. I was just going through a phase where I was playing with different AI APIs, and I wanted to see what I could build with them without intending to really build a fully full-blown product out of it. So in about a span of a week, I spent some time just learning how to navigate these APIs, and I built about 4 or 5 what I called tiny tools on my own personal website, which still exists today, in fact. And one of them happened to be AudioPen. It was just, I thought, what if I combine the Whisper API, which is the audio API? What if I take that and I combine that with GPT, which was, I think at that time, maybe 3.5 or 4, I'm not sure. Just put the two together and play around, see if I can get text from one, put it in another, see what it does with the text. And I did that. It was quite accidental because I'm not the kind of person that records too many voice notes, or at least I wasn't at that point of time. So I didn't see the problem before trying to build a solution. I was just playing. And I was fortunate to have a fairly decent Twitter audience at that point because I'd been building online for a while. And I was just releasing these tools in the wild as I built them. And most of them got a decent amount of love. But this one was one that suddenly struck a chord with way more people than I thought it would. A lot of people reached out saying, hey, this is useful. I could use this for A, B, and C. And I was quite surprised because I hadn't anticipated that sort of response. But I was like, okay, if people think it's useful, maybe I'll just build this as a fully standalone product of its and see if I can make some money on it. So I did that the following weekend during another hackathon sort of event that I organize once every few months. Yeah, built the first version as a standalone product in about 12 hours, launched it. And yeah, I've just been iterating on it for the last 8 months since then.
What was the first MVP like? Did you already... Like,
you can check it out. You can check out the pre-MVP on my own website, luisperera.xyz/tiny, I think, -tools. And then you'll see like a list of tools and click on AudioPen. You'll see what it was when I was just messing around. That was basically, it was a very stripped down version of what the current tool is. At its core, still the same thing, but just the bare minimum I could get away with. And then, of course, the first version of the product was slightly more developed, but still nothing like the product is today, because now there are a lot of like bells and whistles and all sorts of stuff built on top of it.
When you said you launched the tool, so there were like at that point like 3-4 days of work in it, maybe a little more, and then you launched the tool, did you like immediately go the product hunt route, or did you do something like a pre-launch, something just on Twitter to start from?
Yeah, so I actually don't think product hunt is the best place to launch products. I think it's a great place to scale a product that already has some level of product market fit, because I've done that before. I've built a product and someone's approached me and launched it on product hunt for me a day after the product was launched. And it did pretty well. It finished number 4, etc. But the product did not have a monetization model. And all of that hard work into getting a decent rank on product hunt gave me a lot of dopamine, but my wallet was still empty. So after that lesson, I was like, okay, if I build another product that seems to have some sense of PMF and has a revenue model, it's only then that I will start thinking about product hunt. Because otherwise, it's a nice dopamine hit, but it's more of a vanity metric than anything else. If you've not finished those two, not checked those two boxes.
So what was the first initial weeks after launch like for you? Did it immediately explode, or did you have a slower start than people might consider now?
Yeah, I launched it on Twitter and I did get my first few customers almost immediately. In fact, immediately. But of course, that was at a very throwaway price. It was basically just to see if there was demand. And my plan then was, hey, let me sell a lifetime deal to a few people. And if not enough people buy it, I'll just refund everyone and we'll go our separate ways. But I got a lot of people at that point itself. However, it went through a bit of a lull for, let's say, 2 weeks just after launch, where I wasn't really sure what to do. I'm not a marketing genius or anything. I did not have a marketing strategy except for shouting out on Twitter, hey, I built this, check it out. I got fortunate that there was one big Twitter account that found it, and he started using it and wrote like an entire thread on it about how he was using it and pitched it to his followers for nothing. Like, I didn't pay him. There was no affiliate scheme. There was nothing. It was just, he liked the product. He wrote about it and it got a lot of reach. And that kickstarted a flywheel of other people discovering the product and then other people with larger audiences discovering the product and sharing it. And of course, word of mouth, even among people without audiences, just people who know other people in real life, kickstarted from there, I'd say. Like, it gave me a large enough base to start. So yeah, I was lucky in that sense that this person found it. And I'm grateful to him for that. I message him quite often, or shout out to him on Twitter saying, thank you, you changed my life. But yeah.
So after that really big Twitter account started using that and you started to explode, like, how did that feel for you? I imagine that the projects that you did before, we're going to do more questions about that yet, but I imagine that this has been like nothing else has been before, at least for your own products. What did that feel like to just have a product explode in that way? I'm imagining that the MRR, we're not talking about it here, but I imagine still that the growth and the amount of users must have exploded after that, right? What does that feel like to sit there?
It grew pretty fast, but it was also, it was a time where, like, I'm a solo part-time builder. So I didn't get much sleep for about, I think, the first 3 or 4 months of the product's life when it started gathering steam. Because it was an early version of the product, there were a decent number of bugs. There were more and more people finding out about it that weren't very tech savvy. So I was customer support, I was the builder, I was everything all in one. And it was interesting. It was a very hectic time. Like, I put everything else in life on the back burner for a few months until things stabilized. But it was great. Like, I love it. I would do it again in a heartbeat if I had to.
And I imagine that it's also, I'm not sure, because you already like worked a lot in your family business as well. And I read on your LinkedIn that you already exited a company to a YC-backed company before, but that still must have been life-changing that a product explodes in that way.
Yeah, the exit that we had was nothing much. Mm-hmm. It was an old product. It was a real estate firm that I was building about 10 years ago now, or 8 years ago now, that wasn't growing as fast as we wanted it to. It was sustainable, but it was taking us too long to grow it to a level that we wanted to. So we decided to exit, not a life-changing amount or anything. But yeah, at the moment, AudioPen definitely has changed my life in a material way. Remains to be seen how long where it goes from now, but as of now, it's going quite well.
At the beginning, you sold lifetime deals. I think you're not doing them at all now, right? Was there a lot of pressure on your side? Because OpenAI's API obviously costs money and you discounted the product a lot at the beginning. Did you immediately make money, or was there a phase where you went into negative numbers?
So far, there's never been a phase where I've gone into negative numbers. I sold lifetime deals at the start very intentionally, because I feel like, although, yes, it's not sustainable in the long run, it gives your product a nice sort of flywheel at the start where it creates a bunch of advocates. So, for instance, if you become a lifetime member of the Prime version of the product, it is in your interest that this product improves and gets better. So there are two ways you can do it. You can, hey, you're more prone to give user feedback. You tell the builder, here's what I want. Here's how you can make the product better for me. And secondly, you also are more prone to sharing the product with other people because you feel like you're an early adopter. You got in here at ground zero. So you're very proud of it. Like, most people do that. And I look at it almost as like a marketing cost. And I was very clear about keeping lifetime deals available only for the first 6 months of the product's life. And I did increase the prices of the lifetime deal every few weeks to make sure that the earliest adopters got the most rewarded. So to give you some context, like, the first few lifetime deals I sold were at $19, so like 19, which is ridiculous. And when I shut the deal, it was at $150, which is quite a lot higher. I think I could have gone even higher than 150 and still sold a few, but I decided let's just end it at 6 months. And I haven't sold a lifetime deal since then. It's just been annual, and I'm now experimenting with 2-year deals as well. So I offer both those at the moment.
And I've also seen, like, the thing that I want to share here as someone who has used the tool in the months that were after this initial launch phase, the amount of updates that you pushed. I got like an email every 3 days from you. For now, there's 3 more languages and you can write your own style, and you've done so many features and stuff to grow the product, obviously. How did you even handle all the feature requests? We all know that we can't do all the features. How do you even decide what to do and what not to do in the end?
I use the product a lot myself. So while there are a lot of feature requests that I try to entertain and build for other users, I think about 80% of the stuff I build is just like gut feel from what I think the product needs, because I'm a user of the product as well. So yeah, majority of the things are just, I use the product, I feel an itch to have something somewhere or have something do something differently. And then I usually just maintain like a list of things that I need to do. And then I do them. And then I write about them in my email and send them out. But yeah, that's the majority of the development work for new features, at least.
Mm-hmm. Did you at all do like user feedback forms or something to gather more stuff from your users? Or did you get a feature request by email? How did that handle from the user side?
Most feature requests are just email. Mm-hmm. I have a little box in one of the sections on the website where people can just type a message and it reaches me by email. People also respond to the weekly emails that I send with product updates and stuff. I have done a form once, like a simple Google form that just asks people like a very direct sort of feedback. It was useful, but I think it was more useful because I think I used it to validate what I already thought the product needed, or validate the direction I wanted to take the product in, to see whether the user base felt the same way or not. Yeah, so I don't know if I'll do a direct product feedback thing again. I don't know. I'm in pretty new territory for myself as well, right? Like it's the first time I'm building a product that has an existing base of pretty passionate users at this point, and it's not a brand new product anymore. So I want to make sure I don't make any dumb mistakes. I think there comes a point where I might have to switch from just following my gut to doing what you just mentioned, which is doing some more user research. It's very easy to get caught up in the hubris of making the right calls from your gut. But I think that as a product gets older, the risks of doing that get much larger. So I want to be conscious of that in the coming weeks and months.
I think there is some great advice on this in, I'm not sure what kind of publication that was, from the team of Basecamp. Like, the founders of Basecamp wrote multiple books, which are all very good. And one of the things that Basecamp does very well, in my opinion, is that every time they released a new major version of the product, it had less features, which is insane on a corporate enterprise-y world. But somehow for Basecamp, the thing was that they're concentrating on one specific thing that they want to do really well, instead of having 10 things that they do maybe a little medium well instead. I think that's a really good approach, but it's also, I think it's fascinating that you, and I don't mean that in any way negative, that you could go that far and go with your gut and still have a product which is, in my opinion, very well-rounded, very easy to use. And it wakes the question in me, did you do that all by yourself? Did you had UX design help? Did you have help at all? Or did you do all of that yourself?
I've designed it all myself, but I've used a lot of inspiration. So Pinterest is a place I go to quite often when I want design inspiration. I usually find color palettes there. I find certain design elements that I like, and I try to sort of mold the design of anything I'm building based on certain points of inspiration, most of which I find on Pinterest. So yeah, I'm not a trained designer. Any trained designer will look at any of the things I've built and be able to point out very obvious flaws. But for the average person, I think it's good enough. And maybe at some point I will hire someone to maybe give me feedback and tell me exactly what to change in order to make it more, I don't know, more pro, as if a professional designer did it. But yeah, I'm not there yet, but maybe at some point.
As a UX engineer, which has worked for a UX design agency for a few years now, before I went freelance as well, I think that I've seen products look way worse without having any professional input. So I think that's a big recommendation from me. Regarding the people that you already mentioned, like your super fans, like, can you point out, like, do you have like a circle of like 10 or 20 people who are very into the product and are still like communicating with you a lot?
Not 10 or 20. I would definitely be able to find 10 or 20 people that email me quite often about the product. But I have like maybe 4 or 5 people I know that on Twitter, like, I'll be more than happy to DM them when a new feature is getting ready. Or if I'm considering a new feature, I just send them like a quick mock-up of it and ask them, what do you think of this? This is what I'm building. I have 1 or 2 people that will send me like extremely long, detailed feedback videos, which I love. Yeah, it's the first time that's happened to me for any product. I don't know if it'll happen again, but I'm going to enjoy it while it lasts.
What's like the coolest thing that you got sent, or that some customer talked about what they're doing with AudioPen? Is there anything coming up in your brain that's like very special, very favorite thing that someone did?
Yeah, in terms of use cases, yeah, there are a bunch. Like, it's used for a lot of standard stuff, like people writing blogs, people writing emails, lawyers transcribing stuff, etc., which is nice, unexpected, but nice. But I think there are a couple of use cases that I appreciate a lot, or I touched me a little bit. One is just somebody who had an accident and was physically impaired for a while. I think earlier they would use voice to text, the native voice to text stuff on the keyboard. But that's not very good, right? Like you don't always speak exactly what you want to type. There are always grammatical errors, or you've maybe forgotten a point or structured a point badly, etc. So they emailed me a couple of times, wrote a testimonial as well, just saying that it changed the way they communicate because it cleans up what they say. They can just send it across to someone. That was one. Another use case that I found very fascinating was my father. He's not a native English speaker. He speaks English pretty well, but it's not his first language. But he likes to write in English quite a bit. And AudioPen just lets him write his entire... He's a pretty deep thinker. So whenever he wants to share stuff with people about what he's thinking, so mini essays or whatever you want to call them, he just talks to AudioPen now and he gets a nice formatted piece of text that he can copy and paste. And he's actually like writing a mini book about his life and just stories from his life at the moment using AudioPen. Definitely not a use case I imagined while building the product, but something that I'm very... it's made me very happy to see.
I'm just like, I've never even considered that you could give people this tool who are not like native digital users and let them talk about their life. You might have just given me an idea for some of my family members, because there are awesome stories to tell, and those people are not around forever, right? Yep. If we're talking about grandparents and older. I never thought that someone would use your tool for that. I'm not sure why the thought didn't come up, but that's awesome, right?
I didn't think of it either. Just happened and I was like, oh, wow, that's interesting. So
that's really cool.
Go for it. Yeah, and they can do it in any language as well. So even German works perfectly.
Yeah, we actually thought about, so my grandparents are old. Some are already dead. And the grandparents of my SO, so my significant other, my girlfriend, are also getting there, a little younger than mine. And we actually thought about placing like a camera in front of them and tell them, like with professional equipment for audio stuff, tell us the stories that will vanish when you're gone, right? The stuff
There are actually services that do this. I have a friend in Singapore who runs a company. You can check it out. It's called Folklory, Folklory. I think folklory.com or something, where they do exactly this. They're just professional podcasters that you can pay a one-time fee, and they interview people from your family to just get their stories out, and then they give it to you in a format that you can store and share, etc. Yeah, you might find them useful.
Yeah, that's an awesome thing to do. Yeah. Other than that, for AudioPen, I imagine that you are at a phase now where you could live from this, but you still have your family business, right? So maybe you don't have to. What's the plan going forward for AudioPen? Do you have one, or do you just think you're going like one step at a time for now?
Yeah, at the moment, it's definitely still one step at a time. Mostly because I feel like every time I've had a plan for a product, it's not worked out. Like having a grand plan where I determine what the product should be way in advance, 10 steps ahead, and then set about building it only to realize that, hey, you reached step 10, but now nobody wants the product. So I don't want to think too far ahead. So far, it's worked out pretty well for me, just going one step at a time with this particular product. And yeah, I think I'm going to keep it that way for as long as I can.
Mm-hmm. And it worked out very well for you.
Yeah, so far, so good. I don't know what the future holds, but touch wood.
Were people actually coming forward to propose that they buy the product yet?
Did you have proposals? Yeah. I've had quite a few. I'm still in touch with people who keep checking on me every few weeks or months of whether I've decided to sell. But as of now, no, I'm enjoying it too much. Like, I don't want to regret it. Like, I really enjoy where it's going. It's not a crazy amount of work at the moment. It's well balanced. And I get to play around. And I know how rare it is to find a product that people really like. I don't know if I'll get that feeling again. Like, I do want to start building new things again at some point in life, but I think the pleasure that I get from building a product that people already love and improving on it, at least at the moment, is greater than the pleasure I get from building something from scratch. And of course, I can still always just build small products on the side just to scratch that itch.
Do you actually, I asked that question, I think yesterday on Twitter, when you usually start with projects, I think there are some two different kinds of indie hackers. I think, do you start with something where you think that could be fun, or do you always start with something that could make money? That's the two different categories.
No, I think always the first one. Maybe not always, but even if I started with the second approach, which is, hey, can this make money? Can I build it? I think the odds of success are still so low that it's just like, it's not something I would probably follow through on. Like, it's, I don't know how to put it well, but let's say you have a 10% chance of success if you're just building something for fun and maybe people like it. And let's say you have a 15% chance of success if you build something with the goal of making money. Because while you might have a clear monetization model, which is what the second approach implies, you don't know if people still want your product, right? You know that they might have a capacity to pay for a product that solves that particular problem. But A, you're not sure if they even have that problem. And B, you're not sure if your solution's good enough for them to pay for it. So I would much rather just build products for fun and then figure it out, because I don't think the probabilities of success are that far apart in both these cases. I think in the second case, you can fool yourself into believing that it's a much higher probability than it actually is. But if that were the case, like, everyone would be building B2B SaaS products and being successful. And that's just not it, right? Like, maybe people build stuff, but then they don't know how to market it and they just give up before they get lucky or whatever. And I'd much rather just build stuff for fun, because I think the surface area of luck there tends to be larger, because you tend to keep wanting to play. You tend to keep wanting to mess around for fun and exposing yourself to that chance of getting lucky, rather than building a random B2B SaaS just because that industry has money in it.
I think that's also something, like, we both have this part, like, we have day jobs that make money, right? That might or might not be fun. I'm not sure how much fun you take from your family business, but I gotta tell you, I could do without freelancing. And then also putting on top, like, another thing that you're just doing for the money, which doesn't make fun, is like not
exactly
the way, right?
Exactly. Like, you don't want to be working 24/7, right? I think of this as I still think of it as a hobby, and I want to keep it that way, because the moment it starts being work, I feel like I might lose motivation. Like, another thing I think of a lot is, should I hire someone? There have been multiple points in this journey where I was just overworked, overwhelmed, just continuously stressed. And I've always thought, hey, what's the big deal? Just hire somebody to do some of this stuff. But then it becomes a job. Then it becomes responsibility. You're suddenly responsible for this other person or a couple of people to feed their families, maybe, if you're paying them a salary. And I don't want that. I want to be by myself. I want the freedom of being able to build something the way I want to build it, at a pace that I'm comfortable building it.
Is that also a thing that you just do as a developer, or just part of your character? Because I can feel that myself, all the Indie Hacker products that I've built alone, and I think I would also have a problem with employing people for it. That's like a completely different category of things to do, right?
Yeah, I'm not opposed to leading a team. Like, I do that in the daytime. That's a job. I don't want this to be a job. I want this to be something I do because I just want to do it. So maybe I'd be good at it if I hired people, maybe I wouldn't, but I'm having too much, it's going too well for me to want to fuck around and find out, basically.
As long as it still works without having to hire someone, right?
Yeah. I also design most of my products to be able to run with minimal human maintenance or intervention because of the nature of my life. Like, given that I have a job during the day, none of my products should ever require my presence in order to function well. So if you're a person that's paid for my product, you should get exactly what you paid for, irrespective of whether I am, you know, online, offline, working on the product or not working on the product. That's it. I just intentionally designed for that.
What do you do, or how do you design something like that? How do you automate, like, the most stuff so the app could basically run without you?
It's different for each product, but usually when I'm going to build something, I run that through that sort of mental model. I run an idea through that mental model of, am I required to do this? Is my presence required to do this? And if it is, then I either try not to do the idea as a whole, or maybe find an alternative way to solve a particular problem. It's very product dependent. I don't have a one size fits all answer for that.
Like, how do you, I imagine, like, the biggest thing is probably customer support, but what are other things that you should check out if you want to automate that part, kind of way?
At the moment, it's purely customer support. Mm-hmm. I could automate that as well if I wanted to, just by having one of these chatbots that are pretty popular at the moment for $50 a month on the site. I've chosen not to do that intentionally. Like, I'm happy spending an hour a day of my time on average just replying to emails from customers. Because I think it's a young product. I'm a single person team. it helps to remove that layer of, it helps to remove that filter where I can talk directly to customers and see exactly what's going wrong, see what problems are repeating themselves, see what common feature requests people have. And it just maybe fine tunes my own product sense for AudioPen for the future. So at some point, of course, if it gets overwhelming, maybe I'll split that task or figure out how to reduce my load using some sort of an automation. But I don't think I've reached there yet.
I want to talk about one thing that I think you're the first on the podcast that is not a developer and also didn't hire someone to develop for them. You're a no-coder, exactly as the definition. You don't know how to code. You said that before we started the podcast. And AudioPen is built with a no-code tool called Bubble. Why? I probably know why, but why did you choose that route? And is that still the case? Is AudioPen still on that platform?
Yep, AudioPen is still on Bubble and I still don't know how to code. I'm not very proud of not knowing how to code. It's not for lack of trying. I've tried a few times to teach myself how to code and I've never been patient enough to reach the finish line. Always just got annoyed in the middle and was like, okay, screw it, I'll do something else. But Bubble was the first no-code tool that I discovered in 2021, I think, the start of 2021, where it felt like I could suddenly build almost any idea that I had without needing to learn how to code. I'd been dabbling in the no-code ecosystem for a while before that as well, maybe 4 or 5 years prior. And there were tools. The ecosystem was pretty, you know, well-rounded, but every tool had its own limitations and you had to filter any idea through the lens of the tool. You could have idea X, but you'd have to first, your first thought would have to be, hey, can I build this idea with this tool? And for most tools, the answer would be no. So then you'd have to invert everything and then look at a tool and say, hey, okay, what can I build from this, like with this tool? And that's just not a very good, it's not a very good approach to solving problems or even having fun, right? Like you want to just think of an idea and be like, hey, let me go build it. And Bubble was the first tool that let me do that. It feels like it does not have too many limitations. And I've been an advocate for it ever since. And I think it's the first tool that has almost made me not want to learn how to code. Or it's made me realize that given the stage that I'm at in my journey, given the circumstances of my life, where I have a full-time job, etc., and I do this as a hobby, given all of those facts, I think not knowing how to code and just building stuff on Bubble is probably the optimal approach for me. Maybe not for everyone, but for me. And so I've stuck with it so far. And so far, no regrets.
You already said you don't really feel limited by it. Is there things where you still feel like there's a limit between that and developing a product?
For web apps, not really. Of course, you can build maybe 90-95% of anything with Bubble. You may want some code for, you might want to build something from scratch for the extreme case. So maybe besides that, maybe also stuff like, is it as fast as it could be? Maybe not. Maybe Bubble slightly slower for the user. But I feel like people over-optimize for speed on a website and under-optimize for everything else. So I'm not too bothered by that. I think the biggest limitation for me at the moment is building native apps because Bubble can't build native apps yet. I think they have a plan to allow people to do that with Bubble starting next year. I don't know exactly when. But yeah, as and when I decide to build a native AudioPen app, I'll have to make that decision of whether I teach myself how to code, do it with Bubble, or hire someone to do it. But I'll figure it out.
I actually tried using Bubble, I think, a few months ago, actually because of a tweet of you.
Oh.
Because I was building like an audio tool as well, something completely different to you. But I saw that it's pretty easy, or it was pretty easy for you to actually put a recorder on a site and it works in like Chrome, Safari, Firefox. And I think one of the biggest benefits of no-code tools is all those plugins you can choose and then use for your tool. Because it's black magic to get an audio recorder working in every browser. kind of imagine you don't have some issues that we as developers sometimes have because we have to build all of this by hand.
So, yeah, I'm sure. I can't empathize because I don't understand. I've not felt the problems you felt purely because I'm native to this ecosystem, but I'm sure there are plenty.
I think there are big benefits of not knowing that. I think there's stuff like, I can still remember the times where I still worked for the UX design agency and before, where we were supposed to support like the Internet Explorer version 7 and Firefox old version and Opera and Chrome. And you're like, there's a million things we have to fix in Firefox and in Microsoft Explorer, the old one, not Edge. That's the pain that I'm really envious of you that you don't have to feel that.
Yeah, going forward, the world's just tending towards more and more abstraction, especially with AI and stuff. I was just thinking the other day, as of now, we've reached a point where, okay, you can drag and drop stuff and build back-end workflows with that. We've almost reached a point, or we will reach a point in the coming year or two, where you don't even have to do that. The average person will just talk to their computer and tell them, build this for me, and the computer will just do it. So I think no code is going to be abstracted away into some sort of a higher level, where we went from code to drag and drop, and now to maybe just type and get stuff, or talk and get stuff.
How far do you think we're away from that kind of future? I still grapple with that thought.
I've seen some pretty crazy demos on Twitter of, like, of course, very simple websites being built like that. But given the pace of change in the AI industry at the moment, I don't know, man. Like, it's difficult to put a timeline to it. I would want to say 2 to 3 years, but I think given the rate of change, it might even be one.
Yeah.
Who knows? Maybe less than one. No clue.
Seeing the drama at OpenAI offices, yep, where maybe they got AGI working and then somebody flipped out. I'm not sure as well where we're standing in like a few weeks.
Yep.
Yeah. I want to talk a little bit. Sorry, I have one question more for the no-code part. Do you think that you can stay on that platform infinitely? Is it possible to have a million users on AudioPen? I'm not sure how many users you have right now, but is that...
Oh, I don't have a million. I definitely don't have a million. I wish I had a million, but I don't. I don't see why not. Bubble keeps making a lot of noise about the fact that it can handle scale. I'm yet to reach a limit where I felt that it was impaired. But of course, I could always swap out parts. For instance, I could swap out the backend into another tool and use Bubble for the front end. And if required, maybe move out of Bubble as well for the front end. I don't know if I want to. But as far as I can help it, as far as possible, I want to stick to the status quo, because it helps me iterate much faster than having to deal with multiple tools and multiple moving parts.
Do you think there is any value in developers checking out tools like Bubble? Or do you think that... Yeah,
I think if there's value in it, if developers value speed, I think it's beyond question that Bubble or any other no-code tools are definitely much faster for building prototypes, at least in order to test products out. So I know they get a bad rep where people look down upon people who can't code and build stuff with things as if it's some sort of a toy. But I think they overlook the speed advantage that people have while building stuff without code. And I think that far outweighs any of the flexibility that you get with code, at least in the early stages. Of course, as a product matures, that tends to change. But for an MVP, a prototype, hands down, I would say, learn these tools and use them. I don't know for how long, maybe next year, you'll just be able to talk to your computer and it'll do it for you. But until then, yeah, these are pretty useful.
And regarding marketing, we already talked about that most of your stuff is still word of mouth. I'm guessing that's still true, right? But how did that... Did you do anything for marketing at the start that you're not doing anymore? That you start doing something that you didn't do at the beginning? What's the strategy now?
Yeah, I'm still trying to figure it out. I still think word of mouth is the most underrated strategy that most people don't try to get, because it's very hard to get started with word of mouth, right? Like, it's very difficult to build a product that people want to talk about. Like, I've built it purely because, you know, I got lucky at the start. It hit a nerve that I didn't know existed. And I've just iterated on that ever since. But I've built so many products before, none of them have had word of mouth. So either you build a product that has word of mouth, maybe you build a product that has an inbuilt growth loop, like a social media platform, say, where one user automatically sort of spreads the word just by virtue of using the product. But I always want to build marketing into the product itself. Like, I want it to be product dependent, not dependent on some sort of marketing spend on the outside, for a few reasons. Like, one is just, as a solo indie hacker, you don't have time for so many things. Like, you don't want to be spending 2 days a week marketing, whatever that may mean. And also, you might not be good at it. I don't know what to do with marketing. Like, I hired an agency to do TikTok advertising, or not advertising, but like create TikTok accounts and make TikToks about the product. And it was the most expensive failure I've ever had. Like, it was horrible. It was like 3 months of just not knowing what to do, paying these people a ridiculous amount of money and not seeing any impact. And then I had to just pull the plug and say, okay, I made a mistake. Screw it. Let me try a new approach. And ever since, I've done a few experiments, like newsletter placements and stuff. So far, none of them have really moved the needle. I'm still trying. Like, I found a couple of websites here and there where I've paid for ads this week. Let's see if they work. I don't know. But I don't want to rely on paid marketing as the biggest channel. I want it to be word of mouth. And I do have an affiliate program as well, which kind of incentivizes word of mouth a little bit. So yeah, I think those two channels are so far working decently for me. Hopefully that continues.
Do you see a lot of sales through those affiliate marketing programs?
Yeah, for sure. I try and keep it front and center. So once you're an affiliate, you can see your link every time you're in the product. You just have to click one button and you can copy your link, send it to people. I'm fairly generous with the commission as well. I started off at 35% for the lifetime deals. Now that the lifetime deals are not available, it's 25% for any of the plans. So the annual or the two-year plan, which I think is a decent amount for folks sharing it. And I think also the people that are more inclined to share are people that are using the product. So like I check on every affiliate as to whether they are already paying members of the product. And most of them are, like I'd say 90% of them are already paying for the product. So they do see value in it and then they want to spread the word.
So it's not just random people signing up for your affiliate that they're actual users, right?
Yep.
Yep. Awesome. I have one more controversial question for you because we already talked about it a little bit, but I've, like, in my world on Twitter, you were the first one who's building a product like this. And till then, from that point on, I saw a lot of people building stuff that was very close to you. Does that bother you in any way? What do you do with these copycats? What's your mindset there?
Yeah, it bothers me for sure. I don't want it to bother me, but it does. It pisses me off, especially when I see like very blatant clones, which are quite common. And I can tell that they're blatant clones or they're clones of clones because there are certain aspects of the tool that I designed from scratch, certain button placements, certain just actions or animations that are just very obviously copied. So it annoys me. It shouldn't. I wish it didn't, but it does. As of now, like I don't have a strategy. Like I just ignore them as much as I can. And yeah, I just want to keep building. I don't want to be spending my mental energy getting annoyed that people are copying what I'm doing. And in any case, now it's become common enough where I don't think these people are copying me anymore. I think they're copying the copycats. So it's okay. It's a free for all at this point. In the early days, it was personal where I was like, oh, what the hell? I don't vent on Twitter. I don't think the world needs any more negativity. So I don't talk about it in public too much. But yeah, it doesn't make me happy. Maybe a little bit flattered, but not happy for sure.
Yeah, I've come across one of your copycats where I was already using your product and it was a very obvious copycat. And then people were like, I have never seen this product by Lewis. And I was like, were you not on Twitter for the last 6 months?
People, yeah, I mean, it's a big world, right? There are folks finding products everywhere. So it's okay. Like it's the free market. If somebody builds a better product, that's even if they've copied it, I've got to learn to make peace with losing if I do lose in the long run, because who am I to say, tell people what to do?
I mean, a very positive thought that I have had when I saw competitors coming up for my own products, or if I saw something like this, is always, if I'm still a better product, people will still be with me.
Yep, exactly.
It doesn't help just copying something and then doing it worse.
Yep, yeah. I think that's the right approach. That's what I try to do as well, because the more energy you waste being annoyed that people are copying you, the less time you're actually building stuff. So it's better to just block all of that out and just build.
Yeah. I have one very big question for you, because I was going through your website and your LinkedIn and maybe looked a little at the last tweets that you did. And looking at your website and LinkedIn, you started 6 web apps. You started 3 digital products that's just the stuff that you list on your website. You funded this company and sold it to a YC-backed company. You've written countless articles and notes that we haven't even talked about. You organize hackathons. And now, like, one product has actually worked. There's a very famous tweet by Peter Levels who just said that he's 4% of his products worked and he had 70 things started, right? Speaking from the point where you are now, how did you get to the point of success that you can reap in now? What was the winning things to do?
I don't want to take too much credit for the product being successful, because like I said, there was a decent amount of luck involved, right? Like I built the product without really trying to build the product. I was playing around. It happened to be a product that people liked. I launched it, and then for a few weeks it was slow, and then a big account saw it and picked it up, and you know, the flywheel started after. So there was a fair amount of luck involved. But having said that, I think the secret or my strategy going forward, if I build more products in the future, is to just build or do what you like to do. And eventually you'll be doing it for long enough, or you'll have enough shots on goal that you will score. Like, it's just a law of sort of large numbers, right? You just keep shooting, one will go in. Yeah. And I love doing this stuff on the internet. It gives me a high, whether it's writing stuff online, building products, whatever it may be. I just like doing it. So I even if this product wasn't successful, like, I would have just done what I was doing for the previous few years, which is I would have just built another product and then another and another, and eventually one of them would work. And that's exactly what I'm going to do once this is done as well.
Kind of reiterating the point that it's just about, it has to be about the fun at the start, right?
Yeah, exactly. Because otherwise you won't keep shooting, right? If you don't enjoy what you're doing, you're not going to keep taking shots on goal. Like, you don't enjoy that process. So the key is to find something that you like doing. Once you find that, then it just doesn't matter. Like, at some point, you're going to get lucky.
We have two finishing questions we always ask all of our guests. The first one of those, Luis, is what are you excited about right now? And it doesn't have to be anything related to AudioPen, but it can be if you want to.
What am I excited about right now? I think I'm excited about Christmas. Like, it's nearly Christmas. It's a nice time of the year. I have a lot of friends and family coming down in a couple of weeks. It's the 6th of December today as we tape this. Mm-hmm. Definitely excited about the holidays, just to meet folks after a while. Other than that, no, the product's been going well. I think I've reached a stage where I enjoy it, but the excitement has faded. So it's like a nice, consistent, good vibe from working on it, but not an adrenaline rush every morning when I get up and I'm like, oh man, I gotta set my computer, see what's broken and fix it. I'm past that stage at the moment, but I'm enjoying this nice part of this relationship I share with the product.
Also, like, good timing if you have Christmas ahead of you and you can switch off.
Of course.
Perfect. And the last question I have for you is, we're always thinking about the newer indie hackers who might also listen to the podcast. If you had one lesson or advice, you gave one earlier already, but what would be the first or the one lesson you would give someone who's just starting out in indie hacker career?
Yeah, I think I'd expand on the previous point and just say that it has to feel like play at the start. And because of that, you need to have another backup. Like, for instance, I have my day job. So while I was playing around and just building tools for fun, I did not need to rely on them to put food on the table. I'm fortunate to have another source of income that could let me do that. And I would encourage people to do that as well. Don't just quit your job without savings and say, hey, I'm going to build 10 products in 10 months without a cushion, because like, product number 1 and 2 are very unlikely to succeed. So make sure you're playing, but make sure you have a safety net while you're playing around, because that'll just give you a longer sort of timeline to experiment until you can reach a point where you get lucky.
Perfect. That's a perfect outro for the episode. Luis, where can people find you and your product online?
Me on Twitter, x.com. My handle is just my full name, so Luis Pereira. And the product is at audiopen.ai. You can just Google AudioPen, you should find it.
Also put it in the show notes. So, yeah. Perfect. Luis, it was an fun hour to talk to you. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast. Yeah, do you have any last words for listeners?
No, I think we've covered quite a bit. But yeah, if you made it this far, thank you for listening. And yeah, see you guys on Twitter.
Thank you so much, Luis. Goodbye.
Cheers. Thanks for having me.
And that's our episode. Thank you for sticking with us to the end. You can find Luis on Twitter under the handle Luis Pereira, which is LuisPereira. You can find AudioPen at audiopen.ai. You can find the link in the show notes as well. You can find me on Twitter with the username IceBalance. That's IceBearlabs. We have a website you can check it out. We're posting articles about the biggest learnings of each episode there as well. Go to codeandconquer.fm to find out more. You can find this podcast on Twitter, TikTok, and Instagram with the handle CodeConquerPod. And write us an email at hello@codeandconquer.fm. If you're one of the people who listens to this podcast on the Apple Podcast platform or Spotify, please consider rating our show. It lets other people discover this podcast and helps us grow this even bigger. Thank you so much. Till next time.